Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Jean Bricmont, who is the author of a fantastic book that came out in 2006 called Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War, and of a recent article on Counterpunch called The Wishful Thinking Left. He is speaking with us from his home in Belgium. Jean Bricmont, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's wonderful to have you on the program. You wrote this article called The Wishful Thinking Left in response in part to a petition by leftists from around the world about Syria. Can you explain what that was?
The problem with the petition is that somehow it calls on to support, I don't know, the Syrian people struggling for, you know, against the Assad regime, etc. But it's not at all, you see, the problem I had with the petition is that it does not really call for U.S. intervention. But it's not clear, short of that, what it calls for. Because, you see, the conflict in Syria, and that was the case already a few months ago, has reached such a stage that it seems to me that you have the rebel on one side and the government on the other. And then, of course, the population may be in between, but the population can either stay neutral or join one of the sides. There is no real third party. And the rebels, of course, don't want support from Western leftists whom they don't know. They want weapons, heavy weapons, from the U.S. government or from the Gulf states, etc. And I found the petition was somehow, you know, wishy-washy. It wasn't saying, well, let's send heavy weapons to the rebels. But of course, once you say you want you assume that the Syrian people want the overthrow of the regime and don't want the defeat of the rebels, which I know Syrians want the defeat of the rebels, so I don't know how many there are, of course, but, you know, you just assume that everybody wants the government to fall, and then you sort of wish them well without actually making any practical measure. It's something which doesn't have a real effect except a psychological effect on the left here, on the peace movement. By telling people, don't object to the U.S. sending weapons to Syria. My point of view is that, of course, in all these conflicts, going back to Kosovo, you see the humanitarian impulse, which I think, you know, nice in principle but unthoughtful, is leading people on the left to say, okay, we have to support the Kosovar, the Libyan rebels, the Syrian rebels, and maybe the Afghan women, etc. But they don't have any means to do so. It's only the U.S. government who has the means to do so militarily, and if you don't do it militarily, it's not clear what you do. So in the end, they undercut the peace movement, the people like you, who are trying to work for disarmament, disengagement from the United States, respect for international law, etc., etc. So at some point, you see, the left can't have it both ways. They can't, in principle, most of these people are anti-war. Most of these people are for international law. But then what sense does it mean to support? Who are they? What does it mean? Support? You don't support people by, you know, an empty petition. You have to ask for concrete measures. If I ask for the release of Bradley Manning, that's a concrete measure. Maybe unrealistic, but that's something concrete. It's just the psychological effect of this petition that I object to, because in the end it undermines the efforts from people like you and many others to say stop U.S. interventions abroad. Okay? I'm for a non-intervention. I wrote an article also, the case for non-interventionist foreign policy, also on Counterpunch. And my whole argument is that the U.S. should not be allowed to fix the world, and it's not able to, and it's not even of goodwill. But even if it was of goodwill, which I don't think it is, in reality, it would not be able to fix the world. And then once you intervene like that, I think in general you make matter worse.
In your article, you suggest that well-meaning humanitarian interventionists, in fact, have a lot of the information wrong, or at least questionable about Syria in terms of what's been happening in the war.
As I say, I'm no expert on Syria. Maybe some of them are, but you see, I'm always irritated when I see Western leftists who have never lived in those countries, who don't speak the language, have a definite opinion about what's happening in Egypt, what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Lebanon. All when I see in the social network, everybody has his or her opinion, and everybody is convince of this and that. I mean, I'm in a country where there is a Belgium, where there is a linguistic conflict, of course not very bloody. But I'm absolutely certain that people from outside the country won't understand. I don't have a, you know, I don't have a view that my side, which is the French-speaking, is right and the other are wrong. I think it's a complicated issue. But even that, I think foreigners have a hard time understanding without living here, without knowing the languages and so on. I don't see why it would be easier to understand. You see, the way they find it easy, it's easy for them, is the human rights. They look at it as a violation of human rights. And once a government violates human rights or attacks its own people, as they say, then they are the bad guys and the others are the good guys. And it's been like that in every conflict. If you take Yugoslavia, for example, the conflict was complicated. There were Serbs who were expelled from Croatia. That was the biggest ethnic cleansing in the war. That is hardly ever reported. They had reason to fear being expelled from Kosovo, which they were now, etc., etc. So the situation has been immensely more complicated than the media portrays it. But the human rights crowd accept verbatim what the media say, then decide who are the good guys and the bad guys, they have an equal view of the world, and then they take this aspect of human rights, which of course is important, but overrides every other preoccupation, for example, about development, about peace. You see, if a country is at war and is torn apart and it has no state, then how are human rights going to be protected? I don't know if human rights are protected now better in Libya than they were under Gaddafi, for example. I don't know the situation very well, but it seems to be largely chaotic. And then there's this moral problem that I have, you know, that this moral compass of human rights allows you to decide who are the good guys and the bad guys. And in countries where you don't live, and you never suffer the consequence of your own policy, you see? For example, if I oppose certain policies that are done in Europe, okay? I suppose I say that there should be more immigration or there should be no austerity measure, etc. And suppose the consequences are bad, then I'll suffer the consequence, at least I may. But if I say we have to bomb Syria, and then the Syria falls apart and Al-Qaeda kills people left and right there, I'm not going to suffer anything. And it seems to me that there should be at least some restraint when you advise intervention in places or policies in places where you don't live. It seems to me that it just be decency. The same way I'm not going to tell you how to run your life because it's your life, not my life, and vice versa. And it just seems to be the whole... You see, there is an analogy with the part of the what was wrong in the old left. Somehow, you know, in the old left there was an ideal which was socialism. And socialism was justifying everything in some people, not, well, people whom they call Stalinist or Maoist or something like that. But anyway, there was an idea that there is this ideal, and once you look at whether they're socialist and capitalist, and then the socialists are the good guys and the bad guys are the capitalists, and then everything socialists do is right. And then, moreover, the military might of the Soviet Union was supposed to be, you know, in the camp of socialism. I think that was a delusion. But now the left, of course, has completely forgotten that even moderate forms of socialism are forgotten. But now it's human rights and democracy. And that's the absolute good, overrides everything else, peace, prosperity, development, everything. And the military might of the United States now plays the role of the military might of the Soviet Union. And there's the same sort of simplistic Manichaeism, which it seems to me is at work in both of the old left and part of the old left and part of the new left, which I call the new left, the human rights left. But I think it's a serious mistake. And also, as I say, people should first of all mind their own business. I mean, what sense does it make to... I mean, I got an appeal from France now. They want to help democracy in Egypt. How are you going to help democracy in Egypt if you can't do anything for Manning? You can't do anything for Assange? You can't do anything for his boyfriend or Snowden? I mean, all these five people and Morales, I mean, six people, they've been, you know, the most basic rights or the... I mean, these people have done very good things, and they've been, their rights have been denied horrendously by the powers that be in the West. And what does the left do? I'm sure they condemn, they are willing to write petitions. But unless you're actually able to change the situation here, and I think you should work first of all on that, it seems to me that it's meaningless even to say that you're going to fix the situation in Egypt, in Syria, and in Iraq. Well, you see what I mean? Or in Palestine, for that matter.
It seems to me one of the other things you point out in your recent article that's overridden by this simplistic cause is the rule of law, which people who favor human rights typically place a value on the rule of law, but the law doesn't seem to be on their side in advocating the overthrow of governments.
The international law never... the whole campaign, if you wish, from the more aggressive... So the, if you wish, in France, for example, there was Bernard-Henri Lévy and Kouchner and so on, and you have had Samantha Power in the United States and people like that, Susan Rice and so on. They have been, vehement attackers of international law. And Israelis too, by the way. Zionists too, they've always been against international law because international law is on the side of the Palestinians. So international law, which I think is a very progressive measure and something that the left should defend, has always been under attack under the guise of human rights. They've been invited to the UN General Assembly, together with Chomsky, in 2009, I think, to speak to the day of thinking in the General Assembly about this responsibility to protect. At that time, Father Descoto, was Sandinista, was the president of the General Assembly, was the representative from Nicaragua, and he invited us to a debate. And I told them in summary, I can send you the text, I told them in summary, that the United Nations was founded to avoid for mankind the scourge of war. And that was through respect of international law. Then I made a list of their failures in preventing war, like the Vietnam War, for starters. I gave them a list of, all these failures. And I said, you didn't succeed in your primary goal, the goal for which you were founded. Okay, Palestine, etc. And now you're going to put yourself a new task, which is to, prevent a serious violation of human rights by destroying the thing which you weren't able to do in the first place. I think it makes no sense. This whole mentality of the pro-intervention left, I've been fighting them for years now, since 1999, the Kosovo War. But it seems to me that the whole mentality is completely, they have misguided priorities. First of all, you should work in your own country. If you can't influence the policy of your own country in a positive way, you're going to fix the rest of the world. And then you should ask your own country, especially the more violent one like the United States, to step out. And for Europe, we should ask to de-link ourselves from the United States, we are more and more linked to the United States. We are vassals of the United States. The business with, Snowden and Morales is just so unbelievable. De Gaulle would never have done that. And even during the Cold War, we would not have been so subservient to the United States. And now, not only it happened, but there was barely a beep of protest, except in Germany with the... with the NSA thing, but in France there was no protest from the far left, the same far left who is asking to arm the rebels in Syria, etc.
When I hear that we need an intervention in Syria because there are chemical weapons being used, even if they're being used on both sides, so we need to intervene on both sides, whatever that would mean, I wonder at the West, the United States, which uses cluster bombs and depleted uranium and white phosphorus and napalm, but even if they used just acceptable weapons, bullets and bombs, there seems to be no consideration over whether the intervention is going to make things better or worse. It's simply that it needs to be begun as a moral cause. And once it's been begun, then you've accomplished what you set out to do, and who cares what happens next? Is that as far as the thinking goes?
Yeah, that's really... It seems to me that there is, at least what I know, the psychological analysis I do in Europe, is that people are under intense pressure to show, that they are not pro-dictators, they are not Stalinists, they don't support Assad, Saddam, etc., etc. There is an immense criminalization of the West by saying, you supported the Khmer Rouge, which isn't true, you supported Stalin, which isn't true for me, etc. And then don't make the same mistake again. People have interiorized that. And then there's also the Holocaust. So there's always a new Holocaust being created. And then we didn't do anything to stop the Holocaust, which isn't quite true. And in any case, that's not what's going on. There are civil wars, etc. There's an immense psychological pressure, and it's part of the general culture. But unlike the old left, it's sort of... This is an idea which it goes through the right and the left almost, except the far right, surprisingly. The libertarians, for example, in the United States react more favorably, I would say, to what I say than the mainstream left, or the liberals. Certainly the liberals are terrible. But then you find a moral justification, you find a holy cause which doesn't cost you anything. If you criticize Israel, okay, you'll be an anti-Semite. But if you denounce Assad and arm the rebels, you're going to feel holy about yourself, because everybody is going to think it's okay what you do. The powers that be are not going to criticize you. You know, some people in the military may say, wait a minute, you know, Dempsey may say, wait a minute, maybe that's not in the U.S. interest or something. Then you can say, oh, you see these bad guys, they support U.S. interest over human rights, etc. Then you can have a leftist discourse which is actually perfectly functional within the system, but which makes you feel like you're against the powers that be, without suffering any consequence. But nobody's going, you're not going to lose your job, you're not going to be demonized, you're not going to... everything. It's perfectly fine to say that. It's a very comfortable position because, as I say, there are certain realistic tendencies in the powers that be, in the military establishment, etc., in the CIA maybe, who assess, or diplomatic corps even more, who assess the situation differently from the left. And think, oh, wait a second, these rebels, maybe they're not our friends, and should we arm them, etc. And all these people who think in sort of classical, realistic terms can be then branded as being the bad guys who are not for human rights, and then you can sort of denounce them, and then you feel that you are criticizing the powers that be.
It's difficult to form a coalition left and right on an issue, even when, you know, in the United States, the vast majority of people across the political spectrum are against arming Syrians or intervention in Syria.
Yeah.
When you have people from the right, including a congressman who's introduced a resolution to make an invasion of Syria an impeachable offense, who says we must not intervene in Syria because the entire population of Syria is not worth the loss of a single life of a member of the U.S. military. And the people on the left grow outraged and say, well, we need to bomb the Syrians because we care about them and they're just as valuable as we are. So how do we bridge that gap and work together?
Well, but, you know, Bismarck said that the Balkans were not worth the life of a single Pomeranian grenadier. I mean, that was a Prussian, a sort of a German soldier. Well, if Germany had followed that advice, maybe certain wars would have been avoided. I mean, it's not a, you know, it's not a nice way to put it. But then you can say the same thing differently. Okay, you can arrive at the same conclusion. I agree that it's not a nice way to say it. It's very offensive, etc. But that's not the point. The point is what the conclusion, and can you argue for the conclusion on the basis that's not offensive? I think you can. That's what I try to do.
We're speaking with Jean Briquemont, who is the author of Humanitarian Imperialism and of a great recent article called The Wishful Thinking Left. How do we, on the left, explain that whatever the positions taken and whatever the conversation is, it's always about the country that the powers that be want to talk about? So we're not talking about Palestine, we're not talking about Bahrain.
Take Bahrain. I mean, suppose that the left started arguing that Russia should arm the opposition in Bahrain. Well, that might quickly lead to a war, because the Americans wouldn't like the Russians arming the rebels in Bahrain. So that would maybe be like the missile crisis in 62 or 63, etc. So, you know, there would be a risk of a global war, and nobody would want that. But then you could say to those people who don't call for arming the rebels, the opposition in Bahrain, that they support the dictatorship in Bahrain, as they say that I support Assad. I mean, non-intervening is not the same thing as supporting. It's a consistent policy. I like the foreign policy of Switzerland. I mean, is that radical? Is that fascist? Is that Stalinist? Is that what the foreign policy of Switzerland is? Very simple. They defend their territory. They don't send troops abroad, period. But everybody do that. I mean, you know, what's more simple than that? And what's more peaceful than that? And Switzerland is actually well considered as a country abroad, much more than my own country, because of this neutral stand, you know? The Chinese like it. I think many people in the world think it's fine. I mean, And it's, of course, the position of the non-aligned movement. In general, the non-aligned movement, as you know, I quote that in my book. I don't have my book in front of me, but February the 25th, 2003, namely a few weeks before the invasion of Iraq, the non-aligned movement, which groups most of the third world, gathered in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, and they made a declaration saying that question of humanitarian problem must be, solved within international law, within and in the respect of the Charter of the United Nations, which does not allow humanitarian intervention. It was crystal clear, and that was the declaration which has made at the South Summit, it has been said several times that this is the position of the majority of mankind. You could also ask for people who like democracy whether the opinion of the, I don't know how one of your founding fathers called it, the decent opinion of mankind should be taken into account. Speaking of the left-right alliance, I mean, the problem is that you don't have to make an organic alliance since people are reluctant to that. But, of course, you can have single cause. You know, many people have had, like, abortion, gay rights, etc. I mean, if people fight for gay rights, they don't ask them what they think of the income tax, okay? So, and if people were for abortion, it's the same thing. I mean, there are many different types of feminists from the social point of view, and so on and so forth. So I don't see why you could not have a peace movement that doesn't ask people what they think of gay rights and what they think of income tax and so on. I mean, the problem is that as a single issue, peace is, and disarmament and all these things is just off the screen. And the left doesn't seem to care about because of this humanitarian state of mind. And the only people who actually say, is not, I mean, for example, I mean, not the only people because Counterpoint is very good on that, but antiwar.com and Justin Raimundo and so on, and of course also people like Ron Paul and other people are just thinking that the U.S. has enough problem like that and they should stay home and take care of their problem and collaborate with the rest of the world. But I don't see what's wrong with that.
Well, I don't see what's wrong with it either. I completely agree with you. But for the benefit of those who might not, what do you think is the best response to those who say, but we had to benefit the Iraqis, we had to benefit the Libyans, you couldn't leave Rwanda alone, the choice is to do nothing or to bomb Rwanda, you must bomb Rwanda?
It's very easy. You have to say that these crises that they discuss are not made out of the blue like that. They all have a history. And if you look at the history, you will see that the history of intervention is to some extent responsible for that. For example, now the CIA has acknowledged something which I've known for many, many years, and you too, namely that the CIA overthrew Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran. That, I think, was the beginning of actually the movement that led to, for example, the Ba'ath in Iraq, etc., and the nationalization of oil by more violent means. Nobody knows what the history would have been if Mossadegh had stayed in place. Then, of course, the U.S. intervened on the side of Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war. And then they intervene all the time with Israel and supporting Israel against. I mean, you know, they militarized the planet also by sending weapons all the time. If the U.S. kept a policy of keeping at home and defending its border, it wouldn't need any weapon. And then there wouldn't be any weapon industry. And the whole huge, gigantic amount of money spend on weapons could be used on development. You know, I think Chomsky says that there are about as many people who die in Africa of preventable disease every day as died in Rwanda during the genocide period. I mean, why not work on that first rather than fantasizing that we could have prevented the genocide by bombing? The story of Rwanda is complicated because there was an invasion by the, you know, FDR, the Tutsi, if you wish, the military Tutsi coming from Uganda, and that lasted for several years, and there was no negotiation. And plus, after the victory of the FPR, the Kagame people, there was intervention in Congo that led to probably even more death than there were in the, you know, the tragedy of Rwanda. So, in fact, when there was the invasion of Congo, you could have said to Uganda and Rwanda, well, look, you are small countries, you just stop it. You don't send troops there anymore. They did send troops there, and of course they supported rebels there. And there was a huge disaster, and all this is due to intervention, not lack of intervention. I wouldn't say that behind any tragedy there is intervention, but of course in many cases there is. Take the first one that really started the whole human rights industry. That was the boat people in Vietnam and the Khmer Rouge. But who got the Khmer Rouge in power in the first place? Without the U.S. intervention, how could this group, which was marginal under Sihanouk, could take power in Cambodia? The massive bombing campaign of the United States made peasants to go over to the Khmer Rouge, and that's how they took power. And in Vietnam, of course, the destruction of South Vietnam and then the bombing of North Vietnam, of course, radicalized the regime, and that led, of course, plus the destruction of the country led to the boat people, but that's not surprising. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, it seems to me that you have to look at the history of these things. The people, you see, people think that the U.S. policy is fine, and then there are crises like Rwanda and so on, and then we must intervene, and that's it. Nothing else could be done. I mean, people who object to that can't say, oh, well, we don't need any austerity measure, we don't care about deficits and so on. They have to say, we have another policy. We need an altogether different economic policy. And it's the same thing with war and peace. Of course, I'm not saying let's do nothing. I say let's get a totally different policy. But of course, you have each crisis. The left jumps on the bandwagon of the warmonger and asks for more intervention and more war. The different policy is never going to occur because in between wars, there is no thinking given to another policy either. I mean, there was a gap between, let's say, Kosovo and Afghanistan or Iraq and Libya and so on. But very little thinking is devoted to, you know, organizing for an anti-war policy. I shouldn't say that to you because you are one of the main organizers behind that. But I mean, you know, the general attitude of the left is very, very weak on that, I would say. And I think this idea that they have that the U.S. is a force of good and the U.S. military in the end is a force of good is in the back of the mind of many.
There's a wonderful line in your book where you suggest that these human rights groups that desire that wars be fought according to the so-called laws of war and be fought in a civilized manner are aligned with someone telling rapists that they should use condoms.
I think the human rights, we have to live without human rights group because the human rights group are totally penetrated with this idea. Plus, I am afraid that there are people working within those groups to orient the policy of those groups in a pro-U.S. direction, focus on human rights violation, you know, always the same thing, it's China, it's Russia, and so on and so forth. They don't pay any attention, proper attention to what's happening in the United States. I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, we have to build from other organizations than the human rights group. But of course, indeed, I mean, I don't know any war, for example, where both sides don't accuse the other side of violating the Geneva Convention, and usually rightly so on both sides. So, I mean, in fact, you see, it's fine, the Geneva Convention, but the problem is everybody is violating them all the time, and maybe it's a problem with war itself, not just with the convention. I mean, if you fight war, you want to win, and once you want to win, you use the means that are necessary to win, by any means necessary, as Malcolm X used to say. I mean, look at Vietnam. I mean, they bombed and bombed and bombed. In 68, they realized they were getting nowhere, and then the war lasted 5 more years, and they bombed and bombed and bombed. And that's the problem. Once you are drawn into war, it's a macho thing. You need to win, among other things. To me, the human rights movement is really, really outlive this usefulness. I'm not saying it wasn't useful in the beginning as a corrective to, you know, certain cynicism about state power, but still now it's almost in town. I mean, they do protest Manning and things like that, but that's sort of window dressing because there's nothing that's done about it, and there should be a totally different orientation than the one of the human rights crowd. They're not doing any good, I think, for gays in Russia, as far as I can see, because and these minorities are, you know, I know, for example, people who are secular or even feminist in North Africa, and they say, don't help us, don't come to our help, because if you come to our help, then we'll be targeted as agents and Zionists and so on. We don't want your help.
We've been speaking with Jean Bricmont, whose book is Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.